Out There Media Group presents Disinformation, the podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Disinformation, the podcast. My name is Raymond Wiley.
And I'm Joe McFall. Welcome to the show.
Well, Joe, we're actually releasing another episode within a month of the last one. This is epic.
Yeah.
You know, podcast listeners, they're always hungry. You know, like Shelob from Lord of the Rings, they always want to feed. And you're going to be feeding tonight, guys, on an interview with Graham Hancock. And I'm really excited because, Joe, we've been wanting to interview this guy for like 5 years.
Yeah, this is years in the making. And so it was a real pleasure to finally be able to talk to Graham about topics that more interesting than we could have even imagined 5 years ago.
Right. And, I mean, some topics that we actually have talked about in the past, but, man, in a completely different light. And the guy was really eloquent. I'll just put it to you this way. There wasn't much to do in the editing room today. So anyway, we're going to talk about his new novel, Entangled, which is a sort of time slip fantasy novel with psychedelic and ancient history elements. We're going to talk about Supernatural, his book about psychedelic shamanism throughout the world and throughout history, as well as his early works, which some of which were the ones that really got me and Joe interested in the topics we talk about in these podcasts in the first place. I mean, I was so thrilled today when he was talking about Sign and the Seal, which...
Oh, yeah. I read Sign and the Seal when I was like 17, so this is like, you know, 18 years ago. This is probably... I read Sign and the Seal before some of our listeners were born, probably, you know? So it was really amazing to finally be able to talk to Graham about the book that really changed a lot of the way I like to think about history.
Absolutely, and... Well, whatever. We'll forgive you for dating yourself so badly there, Joe. Anyway, we'll be back after the interview with some announcements, and we've got some really cool episodes coming up between now and Christmas, which we'll tell you about when we get back as well. So without further ado, take about an hour and spend it with Graham Hancock. We're back here on Disinformation, the podcast, and it's my great pleasure to introduce you all to author Graham Hancock. How are you doing today, Graham?
I'm good, Raymond. How are you?
I'm doing good, and it's a great pleasure to have you on the phone today. We've got a lot to talk about. Obviously, you have a huge body of work and so many interesting topics you've covered over the course of your career. But we're definitely, more than anything today, going to talk about your new novel, Entangled, which is your first novel. But before we get into that, I think we should talk a little bit about how you got started as an author. I think many of most of the people in our audience are probably at least familiar with your name, have maybe read some of your books already. But you didn't start off as an author who talks about these sorts of what people would describe as strange or fringe topics at first. Is that right?
No, my background was in mainstream journalism and foreign reporting. So I started off in writing as a journalist, and my last journalistic assignment was as East Africa correspondent for The Economist, a very serious political and economics weekly newspaper. And I was based in Nairobi in Kenya, and traveling very widely around the region of East Africa, reporting on the usual current affairs issues that that afflict that area, from famines to wars to business stories, just the whole range of current affairs issues. And my travels took me regularly to Ethiopia. It was one of the major countries on which I reported, and it was in Ethiopia that I had a series of encounters, that information came my way, which initially subtly and gradually, but later in much more depth, completely changed the direction of my life. And really, this was in 1983, and I was up in the north of Ethiopia, in the city of Aksum, an ancient and sacred city of Ethiopia. At that time, it was the center of a war zone. It was completely surrounded by rebel forces. I was interested to go there, and I got flown in on a troop carrier plane and spent three days in this mysterious and magical city. A very ancient city filled with ancient ruins. There are obelisks there. One of them weighs more than 500 tons. There's a huge tunnel system under the ground. There's the most ancient Christian cathedral in Africa, the Cathedral of St. Mary of Zion, which goes back to the 3rd century after Christ. And in the grounds of that cathedral is a little stone chapel surrounded by metal railings and heavily guarded by armed men. And in that chapel, in the grounds of the chapel, I met the monk who is responsible for the chapel, and he told me an astonishing story that behind us in the chapel itself was the true and original Ark of the Covenant, the most treasured, the most important relic of Old Testament times, which, and indeed the disappearance of the Ark of the Covenant from the Old Testament is one of the great mysteries of the Bible. It was a really eerie encounter. I remember it distinctly in the early evening with dusk falling, talking to this old monk with cataracts over his eyes, and a sense that some kind of truth was coming from him, that he wasn't just making up a fable, that there really was something mysterious in that chapel. And it set me off on a process of investigation and inquiry. When I asked academics about Ethiopia's claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant, they said, well, yes, everybody knows this. The Ethiopians make that claim, but of course they're just making it up. It's just a national epic. It's a fantasy that they invented at some point in history to make themselves look more grandiose. But when I looked at the evidence on the ground and found that there was, as well as an ancient tradition of Christianity in Ethiopia, there was an ancient tradition of Judaism. Indeed, there were Ethiopian Jews, the Falashas, who practiced an Old Testament form of Judaism, who had their own story about the Ark of the Covenant and about how it had been brought to Ethiopia. I came to the conclusion that the academics might be missing a trick, and I decided to investigate further. And gradually, over the years that followed, this investigation drew me out of current affairs and into what was to become the focus of my life for the next two decades, which was the really an alternative view of history, a reinvestigation of the history of humanity. And it started with the Ark of the Covenant, and that book was The Sign and the Seal, and it was published in 1992.
Did you have any prior interest in this kind of field before that point?
No, I really didn't. I was totally focused on current affairs. The only area of overlap really is that I have, as a reporter, as an investigator, I feel that I've always stood on the edge of things. I've never felt, although I was working for a mainstream newspaper, I've never felt particularly mainstream myself, and I've always taken a critical, sometimes even a radical view of mainstream pronouncements. So, for example, in the 1980s, I published a book about foreign aid called Lords of Poverty. Now, in the 1980s, foreign aid was considered to be a universal good, and nobody really questioned it. And my book was one of the first books ever to question foreign aid and to ask ourselves, really, is this actually a good thing or not? And I think that perspective of being an outsider and of bringing a radical view to accepted truths did carry over into my investigation of historical mysteries. But really, I had no involvement with history before Ethiopia connected me to it in this very direct way with the Ark of the Covenant.
That's interesting, because a book like that brought you out to a different audience, I think. From the very beginning, an audience that was much more concerned with this idea of alternative history, or shall we even say counterculture? Did you feel drawn to the counterculture at a younger age?
I've always been skeptical of the way that our societies are run, at the way that mind control works in our societies, the way that there is a mainstream accepted view of things which we're all simply supposed to buy into. And so I suppose to that extent, I've always been a countercultural figure. I've always felt that there must be another point of view, that just because, you know, 90% of the human race believe this to be true doesn't necessarily mean that it is true. Just because Professor X or Dr. Y tells me that I must believe this, I don't see any reason why I should believe this. And I certainly found, when I began publishing books about ancient mysteries, first The Sign and the Seal and then Fingerprints of the Gods, that these books did resonate widely with the public. It was as though there was a hunger, a real hunger for alternative information. And this hunger was driven by an independent spirit and by curiosity on the part of many hundreds of thousands, millions of individuals around the world who weren't satisfied with the picture that was being painted for them of our past by mainstream academics. And I really saw my role as providing ammunition to people who thought that way, that, okay, I can get out in the field, I can do these investigations, let's just try to provide some really solid information which raises important question marks over our past as a species, because history is one of the mechanisms of social control in our society. If you control history, if you control the definition of history, if you persuade people to think about history in a particular way, then actually quite subtly and insidiously, you're controlling the way they think about the present and the way they act and behave towards the future as well. And I felt it was really important to give a solid, serious, alternative point of view on our past.
So it seems that, you know, in that mainstream academia has sort of, I don't know, found your work abhorrent in some ways.
Yeah, I ran into a lot of trouble with academic historians and Egyptologists in particular. Clearly, I had stirred up a hornet's nest by questioning views of history, and particularly with Fingerprints of the Gods, which considers the possibility of a lost civilization more than 12,000 years ago, when humanity is supposed to have been at the hunter-gatherer stage. See, history and archaeology have developed a paradigm or a model of how the human story is supposed to look, and basically it's like this, that we were hunter-gatherers in what is called the Upper Paleolithic, the end of the Stone Age. We were nomadic tribal peoples wandering from place to place, hunting and gathering for our living. Then, around about less than 12,000 years ago, 10, 8, 7,000 years ago, you get the introduction of agriculture. You get the first megalithic structures beginning to appear. You get the first major settlements, no longer transient camps for hunter-gatherers, but villages, then towns, then cities. About 5,000 years ago, you see the dawning of the first great civilizations, ancient Egypt and ancient Sumer, with their systems of writing and documentation, and thus with the beginning of true history, because history does depend on documents, and the first documents that we have date to about 5,000 years ago. And so it's been seen as a kind of steady evolutionary progress from primitive cavemen through the whole process of agriculture and the development of cities and civilizations until you get to the modern world, and we ourselves are seen as the apex and the pinnacle of all human achievement. In other words, it's a straightforward Darwinian model applied to human society. And by suggesting that that model could be wrong, that there could have been a whole earlier cycle of civilization that we've just lost all trace of, by suggesting that we are in fact a species with amnesia, who've forgotten our own past, and by providing evidence for those suggestions, I was disturbing the foundations of the entire archaeological and historical model. And because I wasn't alone, because there were other researchers like John Anthony West and Professor Robert Schock at Boston University, who've done incredible work on the antiquity of the Sphinx from a geological perspective, or Robert Boval, the engineer who first drew attention to the astonishing similarity between the pattern of the three great pyramids of Giza on the ground and the pattern of the three stars of Orion's belt. Because there were a whole group of us working away and providing evidence from different quarters, we became a serious threat to the mainstream academic model of history, and that threat was responded to with, you know, really vicious and unpleasant personal ad hominem attacks on us as individuals, as well as on our work. And for a number of years during the certainly during the 1990s and into the early 2000s, this was a very hot issue and a very hot debate. And it was really intriguing to see the political elements of this debate. You could definitely see that here were a body of people who felt that they had been solely appointed, as though they almost had a divine right to tell the story of history to us, and that anybody else who tried to present a different narrative was some kind of heretic or even a criminal. That's how I found myself being typecast. So it was a very interesting period, and it was quite unpleasant at times. But I discovered as I went along that these academic historians and Egyptologists are also violently unpleasant to each other as well, and that there are incredible internal disagreements amongst them, and that the whole thing is riddled with bitchiness and unpleasantness, really.
All of academia seems to be that way. We interviewed Robert Bouval about 2 years ago, and what I found interesting is that some of his theories seem to have gained, if not like mainstream academic acceptance, at least like popular acceptance. And do you think that your work might gain that same sort of popular acceptance?
Well, no, I think, it clearly did. My work clearly did gain popular acceptance. I mean, Fingerprints of the Gods, which is certainly my best known book, and which argues the case for a lost civilization wiped out in the cataclysms at the end of the last ice age, that book has sold more than 5 million copies around the world. It's been an enormously popular book, and I think it has had an effect, particularly on the way the younger generation look at history, which I'm very, very pleased to have played a part in leading people to be more skeptical and more questioning about the story of the past that is given to us by mainstream historians. But actually winning this battle and getting the establishment to accept that there might have been a lost civilization, that I certainly have not succeeded in doing. But I think I have persuaded a lot of people that this idea is at least worthy of further inquiry. And for many intelligent people who are inquiring into these matters themselves, I think what my work has done and the work of others is provide them with ammunition to take their own studies further.
I think you make a good point there. And I think a lot of our audience many of them have already read Fingerprints of the Gods, I would say. And I've noticed in conversations that I've had with you and some interviews and some things that I've read, you've mentioned a book called Hamlet's Mill as being very influential on you in Fingerprints of the Gods. Could you maybe take a moment and just introduce our audience to this book?
Yeah, Hamlet's Mill is an incredibly important book. And it's written by two professors of the history of science, by Giorgio Di Santillana, who was professor of the history of science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and his co-author, Hertha von Deschend, who was professor of the history of science at Frankfurt University in Germany. The book was actually published in the 1960s, and it's such an obscure and difficult academic text that for many years it was ignored, and I definitely played a part in bringing it out of obscurity when I drew attention to it in my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, because what this book, Hamlet's Mill, does, and remember it's by two esteemed professors of the history of science, is that it shows that a kind of coded message appears to have been passed down to us in myths and traditions from the deepest antiquity, in myths that predate the beginning of any known civilization. And these myths often concern global cataclysms, particularly global floods, and they all include specific numbers, an eerie repetition of a sequence of numbers. And these numbers all turn out to be based on the number 72. So, for example, in the myth of Osiris in ancient Egypt, we find that he is plotted against and murdered by his rival Set with 72 conspirators. I won't go into the details here. It's all thoroughly documented in Fingerprints of the Gods, but there are just thousands of myths from all around the world that repeat this same sequence of numbers, and they appear to do so in cultures that were not in contact with one another. So 72 times 30 is 2,160. Double that is 4,320. 72 plus 36 is 108. Half of that is 54. It's a sequence of numbers based on additions and multiples and divisions of the number 72, and the case that Santillana and von Deschend make in Hamlet's Mill is that all of these numbers are there because they record ancient observations of an extremely difficult to observe astronomical phenomenon. And that phenomenon is called the precession of the equinoxes. And it unfolds at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. It's why we have this notion of astrological ages. Everybody's heard of the song, we live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius, but not many people realize that that idea relates to the precession of the equinoxes, that there's a wobble on the axis of our planet, and it's very slow, and it takes 25,920 years to complete a whole cycle. You know, if you envisage something like a very fast-moving spinning top, as it begins to slow down, you'll notice that the top starts to wobble and that the upper part of the top begins to transcribe a circle as the wobble takes place. That is precession, and that's what happens to our planet. And because our planet is the viewing platform from which we observe the stars, it results in changes in the orientations of the stars, and it affects the rising times of the stars against the background of the sun at particular times of the year. It's really very difficult to observe. It's something that modern science has got a grip on, but the notion that it would have been known in deep antiquity is quite unacceptable to mainstream science. Yet here was this book documenting observations of this phenomenon, linking it to global cataclysms and tracing it back deep into prehistory. And I began to wonder, could this be one of the fingerprints? Perhaps there are many others of a lost civilization which passed down information to us through myth and tradition, and it really played a very important role in my research for Fingerprints of the Gods.
It's just this idea that you're talking about that has been picked up by within the 2012 meme that's going around so hard right now. This is what you talk about in 2012 Science or Superstition.
Yeah, the 2012 meme is also about precession. I think most people are aware of, and I must pay tribute here to the very important work of my friend and colleague John Major Jenkins, who is one of the most serious and important researchers of 2012. And he's shown that the date of the 21st of December 2012, which marks the end of the Mayan long count calendar, happens to coincide with a very interesting moment astronomically, and this is when the sun on the winter solstice is seen to rise against the background of the center of our galaxy, of the center of the Milky Way. And it's clear that this is what the Mayan calendar coming to an end on the 21st of December 2012, or at least the current cycle of the Mayan calendar is aimed at, and that the ancient Maya had that same sophisticated knowledge of precession, which is expressed in all of those ancient myths, and they were able to calculate the skies forward, rather as we can do with a modern computer program, that they were able to calculate them forward and work out that there would come a time when the background stars against which the sun would rise on the winter solstice would be those at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. That's an astonishing feat of science in itself, and it gives a solid astronomical basis to why the calendar ends when it does, which happens to be the 21st of December 2012 when we translate the Mayan glyphs into our calendar system.
John Major Jenkins, both him and yourself were tapped for Roland Emmerich's 2012 film. Do you have sort of any interesting stories to tell us surrounding that? And could you also tell us how you took the movie, or if you liked it?
Well, the trouble with the movie is that, like much in Hollywood, arrangements surrounding movies are surrounded by all manner of ferocious legal restrictions, and I'm extremely limited on what I'm allowed to say without risk of being sued by a very rich man. But which really I don't have time for at this stage of my life. But it is a fact that my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, is credited in the credits for 2012 as providing partial inspiration for the film. And Roland Emmerich has indicated in an interview that he gave to the magazine Time Out in London that it was through reading my book that he first got the hook that enabled him to produce the movie 2012. And I guess what that is that Fingerprints of the Gods is probably the first book that puts together information about the Mayan calendar with information about a phenomenon called Earth crust displacement, and suggests that this might have been what the ancient Maya were warning us about in the calendar. And the Earth crust displacement theory is the work of an American professor, also of the history of science, Professor Charles Hapgood, again back in the 1960s, who suggested that ice ages may be caused and ended by cataclysmic movements of the crust of the Earth. In other words, when you get a massive formation of ice on the planet, it's because that area of the planet is close to the North Pole. And he envisaged the planet rather like a gigantic orange with a loose skin, and that occasionally, from time to time, geological forces would result in the entire outer skin of the planet moving in one piece around the core, shifting areas that were close to the pole much closer to the equator, resulting in a massive ice melt, and at the same time shifting areas that were in relatively warm latitudes closer to the poles, and resulting in the buildup of ice on those areas. And if such a geological process does exist, it would indeed be cataclysmic, and that was what Emmerich portrayed in his movie 2012.
It was certainly more over the top than the Poseidon Adventure, I've got to say.
Yes, it certainly was. I mean, I feel that the film would have been stronger if it had included an archaeological element, but it did not do so. It focused on special effects and drama and all of the things that Hollywood loves. I mean, the special effects were actually quite realistic to what would happen if there were a displacement of the crust of the Earth. But I'm by no means convinced that the Maya are warning us about a coming blind global cataclysm. The Mayan traditions, like all of the traditions of the ancient world that refer to global cataclysm, always implicate humanity in this matter. In some mysterious sense, it's our behavior, our choices, the direction that we go in as a species, which plunges us into periods of darkness and destruction, and therefore we have to take responsibility for that. And it raises the possibility that we don't have to face a global cataclysm in 2012, that humanity can still make choices that could lead us in a more positive and worthwhile direction.
What's your take on the idea that 2012 holds some mass shift in human consciousness?
Well, first of all, it's important to be clear, and again, John Major Jenkins' work really underlines this from the astronomical point of view, that the Maya were more... when we focus on the rising sun against the center of the galaxy, we're actually looking at a window of time which is about 80 years wide, you know, which takes us back from the 1970s or 80s through into the middle of the 21st century. And I must say, if ever there were a period in human history when it could be said that we stand at a crossroads, when it could be said that it would be possible for a huge transformation of consciousness to sweep across the planet, it would be in exactly that window of time. We do live in very troubled circumstances right now. There is a tremendous amount of fear and hatred and suspicion being sown and deliberately manipulated by politicians, by the military-industrial complex. It seems that by encouraging us human beings to fear and hate each other, the powers that be are able to keep us under control, and enormously sophisticated forces are at work in sowing dissension and creating more fear and hatred and suspicion amongst the peoples of the world. But I do sense very strongly a huge reaction to this as well, and a growing skepticism about the mind control of governments, and a growing independence of mood. And the internet has undoubtedly played a huge role in this, enabling peoples from all different cultures of the world to communicate directly with one another and to discuss issues directly. So I actually am hopeful that we live in a time that will see a transformation of the human species, when we will throw off the chains in which our minds have been enclosed for so long, and wake up to our true potential as fully conscious beings. I think that we're definitely living in a time when that could happen. We're also living in a time where we could be so misled and so misguided by negative and evil forces in our society that humanity is perhaps perfectly capable of wiping itself out. You know, I shudder to think, really, of the number of nuclear warheads presently floating around the Middle East. I mean, Israel is rumored to have at least 100. Pakistan has 100 nuclear warheads as well. And there's a deeply unreasonable state of mind revolving around the entire problem of the Middle East, which very easily in our lifetimes could lead to cataclysm. And there are also the gross and grotesque mistreatment of the Palestinian people, which fuel anger on their part. And you know, maybe it's time that the world woke up to this. When there was terrible injustices being done in South Africa in the name of apartheid, the world responded and applied sanctions to South Africa. And I think certainly the way that Israel today is behaving towards the Palestinian people, it's time that the world took some responsibility for that. And disciplined Israel and prevented Israel from behaving in such a negative way towards the Palestinians and creating more hatred and fear. We can't go on fueling this cycle of hatred and fear. Somewhere it has to be broken. And it seems to me that those who have the most power and the most wealth and who are in the most secure and the most strongly reinforced positions should be the first to show generosity of spirit in this regard. And it just may be the case in our lifetime that we will see either a man-made disaster brought down on our heads or an awakening to consciousness and a new willingness to move forward as humans with love and with decency and concern and care towards one another. And ultimately, the choice is ours.
Do you think that the ever-increasing rate of acceleration of technological innovation has some role in what's to come? I mean, obviously it does, but I think that in some ways it's underestimated right now. We think the internet is kind of the end of technology, when clearly in some ways it's just the beginning of what.
Well, I think for me, actually, the problem is that we have created a kind of monstrous society that believes that everything may be achieved through technology, that somehow the whole story of human development should be focused on the issue of technology alone, that any problem can be solved with technology, that we've come to define ourselves in terms of our amazing technological achievements. And I think that actually what this has done is it has deeply unbalanced Western society. We've moved much too much in the direction of materialism, the material realm, defining ourselves in material terms, looking for material solutions to problems, and forgetting about the spiritual side of mankind, which is of at least equal importance. And if we go on trying to solve the world's problems with technology alone, without considering the spiritual dimensions to those problems, then I think we will never, never, never succeed. So my main problem with technology is the fact that it has come to be defined as our sole and most effective mechanism from dealing with our problems, and I don't think that's the case.
Now, and when you say problems, I think in many ways you're pointing back to this postmodern kind of stress that you were talking about earlier.
Well, I'm talking about the whole state of the world. I mean, for example, consider the environmental issues in the world today. When we talk about global warming and environmental issues, we tend to talk exclusively about technological solutions to these problems, about reducing our carbon footprint and so on and so forth, new technologies that will be less polluting, less damaging to the environment. But really, I think we have to address the spiritual state of mind that has led us as a species into suicidal acts. You know, for example, the ongoing horrendous destruction of the rainforests around the world, whether in Indonesia or Central Africa or South America in the Amazon. The very fact that as a species we've been prepared to allow this to happen at all suggests to me some very profound and damaging spiritual imbalance in human nature. And if we don't address that imbalance, it doesn't matter how great technologies we develop, we're still not going to fix the problem.
So Terence McKenna talked about, the late great Terence McKenna talked about what he called an archaic revival, like a return to, I think his terms were, the last sane moment that we knew as a species, which to him was sort of a return to like a hunter-gatherer kind of spiritual mindset. And maybe this is a good time to sort of talk about your two most recent books, Supernatural and Entangled.
Sure. Well, absolutely. And I'd like to begin by expressing my deep appreciation, respect, and regard for Terence McKenna and for the brilliant work that he did. And although he unfortunately has passed away, I'm so glad that his voice is still with us in the form of recordings found all over the internet and available on CD everywhere, because Terence McKenna was one of the great minds of the 20th century and a great thinker. And this notion of the archaic revival, I think it's a really important idea. We're not going to return unless humanity really turns on itself and destroys itself. We're not going to return to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. I think the challenge for the West is to integrate technology and the achievements of Western civilization with a whole other way of looking at the world. I feel that shamanism is of fundamental importance in this matter. In modern industrial societies, we've tended to devolve the spiritual side of life to the mainstream religions, whether we're talking about Christianity, Islam, or Judaism. These three great monotheistic faiths are seen as the the holders and as being responsible for all spiritual aspects in our lives. And this is really terribly unfortunate because actually, in my view, all three of these religions are about as far away from true spirituality as it is possible to get. These have become huge, powerful bureaucracies dominated by angry old men who impose their views on us by claiming to be the sole intermediaries between us and the divine realm. And this is where shamanism has so much to teach us, because if we go to the few remaining tribal and hunter-gatherer societies in the world today who still do practice shamanism, we will find individuals who are not drawing on a body of lore or doctrine to tell us what to think about spiritual matters, but who are exploring direct living spiritual contacts in their daily lives. Shamanism, fundamentally, wherever it's found in the world, is a series of techniques for altering consciousness, for shifting our consciousness away from its focus on the material realm, for dimming down the lights, if you like, on the material realm, and for raising the lights up on spiritual, non-physical realms. That's what shamanism is all about. That's what Western society has completely forgotten how to do. That's what the mainstream religions utterly fail to do. And that's what we need to learn to do again if we're to create a fully integrated society. We need a new form of shamanism and a new form of direct experience of spirituality, I think, if we're going to rebalance our societies. Clearly, the mainstream religions are not going to do that. Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are at the heart of the horrors that are being unleashed in the world today. And if we want to end those horrors, we certainly cannot turn to these instruments of prejudice, oppression, hatred, fear, and cruelty that have been with mankind for so long. We need a new way forward into spirituality. And curiously enough, that will be the very oldest way. It will be a return to our shamanic roots. But if it's going to work, it has to be integrated with all the other things that we have achieved in Western society so that some kind of balance can be found.
Can you talk about your personal shamanistic journey and how it's changed you as an author?
Yeah, it's had a really very, very dramatic effect for me. And this began with my research for my last nonfiction book, which was Supernatural. I've always felt, as a writer, as a researcher, as an investigator, that it's important for me to put myself directly into my story. I can't simply sit in an armchair and read books and then write a book myself. I need to get out into the field and experience what I'm talking about. So that's why when I wrote my book, Underworld, I spent 6 years scuba diving all around the world looking for underwater ruins submerged by rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age. I could have read about some of that stuff in books, but I felt it was important to get underwater myself and really have a hands-on experience of this mystery. And it was the same with shamanism and altered states of consciousness. I found in Supernatural that I was writing a book about the role of shamanistic experiences in the emergence of human civilization. And therefore, it became important for me to have shamanistic experiences myself. And it's just a fact that shamanism all around the world, wherever it's found, the single unifying factor is altered states of consciousness. And more often than not, these altered states of consciousness are brought on by using powerful visionary psychedelic plants. So I went down to the Amazon, and I sat with shamans there in the Amazon, and I began to drink the powerful psychedelic brew that's been used in the Amazon for thousands of years as a vehicle to enter the spirit world, the brew called ayahuasca, meaning the vine of souls. And I found my experiences with ayahuasca, which began as a research project, but which have continued as a personal spiritual exercise long after the research project was complete, have indeed fundamentally changed almost everything about my life. Ayahuasca There's evidence, by the way, archaeological evidence for the use of ayahuasca in the Amazon going back at least 4,000 years. Ayahuasca is used by virtually every indigenous culture in the Amazon jungle, and it has spread out of the jungle, and it's found now in the cities of Brazil and Peru. In Brazil, you have the Santo Daime and the União de Vegetal, which are both syncretic churches that mix elements of shamanism with Christianity and use ayahuasca as their sacrament. And ayahuasca has spread out of South America entirely, and it's now possible to participate in ayahuasca ceremonies really all around the world in virtually every country. And this is the remarkable spread of ayahuasca around the world is happening because the experiences that it allows us to have are transformative and are found to be valuable by individuals all around the world. And it operates at least two very clear levels. At one level, ayahuasca will work with you as a person. And you will find yourself once you're an hour or so into the ayahuasca journey, and ayahuasca will typically take you on a journey that lasts 3 to 5 hours. Once you're an hour or so into it, you will often find yourself reviewing aspects of your past life. You're shown scenes. It's really like a life review. You're shown scenes from your life, and you're shown how you behaved towards others at particular crucial moments. And whereas up until then, you may have persuaded yourself that a particular nasty or cruel word that you said, some harsh or unpleasant act that you committed, was okay, it was acceptable, of course you were justified in why you did it, you were provoked, etc., etc. Ayahuasca will not allow you to make those excuses. It shows you exactly how you were, without any self-flattery, without any illusions, when just in the cold light of day, you're shown the truth about yourself. And many people, myself included, find this aspect of ayahuasca incredibly valuable. It's painful. It often leads you to break down in tears in the middle of an ayahuasca session, but you come out of it filled with a strong motivation to change yourself for the better as a human being, to become more nurturing, to become less toxic towards others, to introduce love into your life rather than hatred and fear and suspicion. This is the first thing that happens with ayahuasca. And the second thing that happens as you move beyond that phase is that you are plunged into seamlessly convincing parallel realms, utterly different from this day-to-day world in which we live in on the earth. And in those realms, you meet intelligent entities construed by the shamans of the Amazon as spirits who have teachings to give you. And again, it seems to be part of some gigantic project for the betterment of mankind. There's been a huge amount of scientific work done with ayahuasca. The Hoasca project in South America involving the Harvard Medical School studied long-term users of ayahuasca, people who'd used it for 15 years or more, and was able to document no negative effects, only positive effects in their lives. There's compelling evidence, really intriguing, that drug addicts, people who are addicted to heroin or cocaine, if they drink ayahuasca, in a structured setting, are very likely to be able to get rid of their addiction completely. There's a clinic in Peru called Takiwasi, run by a French doctor, Dr. Jacques Mabit, and they bring heroin and cocaine addicts there for a month, give them a dozen ayahuasca sessions, and at the end of it, more than half of them have completely conquered their addiction and never returned to it again. And this is because of revelations about themselves that they receive during the ayahuasca journey. And in the Amazon itself, there is a view that an intelligent spirit lies behind the ayahuasca brew. They always see her as female. She is very often depicted as a serpent, and she is seen as using the ayahuasca brew as a way to contact humanity and to guide humanity on a more positive and better path. And I have to say, extraordinary as all of this sounds, And even though I have always approached my work from a very rational perspective, my own experiences with ayahuasca have convinced me that this is indeed the case, and that we are that we are dealing with a powerful, beneficent, and loving spiritual entity who seeks the best for mankind and who seeks to influence our consciousness through the ayahuasca brew.
Isn't there an odd sort of an odd coincidence or just an odd part of the story about the ayahuasca brew? It's made of two different materials, and the natives there have strange tales for how they learned to put these two.
Well, yes, it's a real mystery of ayahuasca. You have to remember that there's 155,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon, and two of them need to be found and mixed together to make the ayahuasca brew. And just to give you a little bit of the chemistry, the active ingredient of the ayahuasca brew is the Schedule I drug that we call dimethyltryptamine, DMT. And DMT is found in the leaves of a bush that's called chacruna in the Amazon, and its botanical name is Cicotria viridis. Now, the thing about DMT is that it is not normally orally active. You can smoke DMT, and indeed you can inject DMT, and it will go straight to the brain. But if you take it through the oral route, if you consume DMT and take it into your stomach, there's an enzyme in our stomachs called monoamine oxidase, which neutralizes DMT on contact. So accordingly, you can ingest through your mouth huge amounts of DMT and have absolutely no effects whatsoever. The other ingredient of the ayahuasca brew is the vine itself, the ayahuasca vine. And it turns out that the vine contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which switches off the monoamine oxidase in our stomachs and allows the DMT in the leaves to become orally active. It's really an astonishing, if you like, pharmaceutical achievement to have found these two plants and to have put them together out of the entire 155,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon. And when you ask the Amazonian shamans, how did their ancestors learn to do this? They say it's really very simple. The spirits told us to put these two plants together, because if we were to put these two plants together, then we would be able to communicate with the spirit world more easily. And it's very strange, but that precise idea echoes something that was said again and again in a scientific study that was done at the University of New Mexico in the 1990s. And that scientific study was conducted by Dr. Rick Strassman, who's a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico. And he was the first American scientist for more than 20 years to be given permission by the federal government to work with human volunteers and a major hallucinogen. And the hallucinogen that he gave them, in their case by intravenous infusion, by injection, was dimethyltryptamine. Now, DMT given in pure form rather than mediated through the ayahuasca brew produces a very rapid, short trip. Ayahuasca will take you on a 3 to 5 hour journey, but DMT smoked or injected will take you on a 12 to 15 minute journey. And in the case of Rick Strassman's volunteers at the University of New Mexico, they were lying on a hospital bed. They were given DMT by intravenous infusion. They went on this 12 to 15 minute journey. And when they returned to normal states of consciousness, Rick Strassman would interview them and ask them to report on what they could and what they had seen and what they had experienced during their DMT journey. And amazingly, very large numbers of them, although they were not comparing notes and were not in contact with one another, reported encounters with the same mysterious entities and beings who very often took the form of part human, part animal hybrids. And in a number of cases, these mysterious entities or beings told the volunteers, "We're so glad you've discovered this technology," meaning DMT, "now we'll be able to communicate with you more often. precisely the same idea that shamans speak of concerning ayahuasca in the Amazon. And Rick Strassman, as the primary scientific researcher in this field, really his work is unique. It has not been no further research has been done since he stopped his project in the mid 1990s, and therefore he's an absolute authority on this field. And he raises the intriguing possibility that what DMT may be doing is retuning the receiver wavelength of the brain. And allowing us to actually gain access to parallel universes or parallel realms, to dark matter, if you like, to levels of reality that are not normally accessible to our senses. And Rick points out that as well as being a Schedule I drug, DMT is a natural neurohormone of the human body. Our own brains produce DMT. You and I and everybody listening to this show has DMT in their bodies, in their blood, in their cerebrospinal fluid, in their urine, in sub-psychedelic quantities. But it may be the case that the body sometimes produces a surge or a spurt of DMT, which may explain a whole level of extraordinary, spontaneous, visionary experiences. And what really lies behind this whole analysis is a new view of the brain. You know, consciousness is one of the great mysteries of science. Really, science has no explanation for what consciousness is. There's an assumption that consciousness is simply generated by our brains, the way a factory makes cars. But this is not a fact. It's not demonstrated by any empirical evidence. It's simply an assumption of science. And it's equally possible, and Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico takes this view, that the brain may actually be a receiver or a transceiver of consciousness. And if that is the case, then indeed we could, by shifting the receiver wavelength of the brain, pick up, if you like, other broadcasts, other realms that we normally don't see. And perhaps these are the same realms that quantum physicists call parallel universes or parallel worlds, and perhaps they are inhabited by intelligent beings, and perhaps that's precisely who we get in contact with in these deeply altered states of consciousness. I was looking for an explanation of why there had been a huge change in human behavior between 40 and 30,000 years ago, when the first great cave art began to appear, cave art documenting encounters with supernatural beings. At that same moment, we have this tremendous leap forward in the evolution of human behavior. And I began to realize that these events might have been connected, that experiences in visionary realms may have put us in contact with what I call the ancient teachers of mankind. We can find modern examples of this in the case, for example, of Francis Crick, the discoverer of the double helix structure of DNA. It came out after his death that Francis Crick had first seen a vision of the double helix while he was under the influence of LSD in the late 1940s and early 1950s. He was a regular user of LSD, so it was a visionary experience that led Crick to one of the most fundamental discoveries of modern science. And I know the case of geneticists who've gone down to the Amazon and drunk ayahuasca and have returned with incredible insights into their field that have enabled them to advance their science further. I know of artists, for example, Alex Gray of the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors in New York, or Robert Venosa and Martina Hoffman from Boulder in Colorado, whose art has been utterly transformed and taken in a completely new direction by their work and experiences with ayahuasca. Consider the computer revolution in the 60s and 70s, the incredible music of that period and the role that psychedelics played there. And again we see, contrary to the propaganda of our societies, that experiences in deeply altered states of consciousness may be absolutely fundamental to the further evolution and development of the human species, and that we should not be afraid of these experiences. Rather, we should embrace them and explore them with respect, with responsibility, and with an attitude of inquiry and a willingness to learn.
Do you feel that these experiences are what we need to, I guess, turn us away from our current crash course over a cliff, as it were? And this if is so, very how, much, how viable is that? How sustainable well, this and viable is, this is that?
I think it's highly viable. And what I see all around the world is a new respect for such experiences emerging. I'd like to emphasize that in my view, the psychedelics are not appropriate for recreational activity. I know that they are used for recreational purposes by some in the West, but I honestly think this is a mistake. These substances are about deep personal and spiritual inquiry. And such work can sometimes be very difficult work, and it's better done in a carefully controlled setting where there is reverence and respect for the substance being taken and where experienced individuals are present, preferably fully trained shamans, to help with the psychic difficulties that some may encounter. And what I do see amongst young people today in the West is a new reverence for these substances, a moving away from the recreational model and a moving towards the spiritual aspect of these substances. The way that ayahuasca has spread around the world stunningly fast in the past decade, the way that ayahuasca is winning legal struggles. For example, members of those Brazilian syncretic churches in the United States may now legally drink ayahuasca in New Mexico, in California, in Oregon, as a result of decisions of the Supreme Court that it's their right to do so under laws of religious freedom. Yes, I definitely see this ancient shamanistic brew coming out of the Amazon jungle and changing people's minds everywhere it touches us in the world today, and perhaps indeed coming to our rescue at the 11th hour.
So it touched you so deeply it turned you into a novelist.
It turned me into a novelist. Like I said, there are many examples of ayahuasca working with the creativity of individuals, and my particular creativity concerns writing and words. And really, after I had finished writing Supernatural, my last non-fiction book, I began to feel strongly that I should try my hand at fiction. I began to feel an urge to write fiction, but I wasn't sure if I could do it or exactly what I would do. And having worked with ayahuasca for several years before that, I decided to go down to Brazil and have a series of 5 ayahuasca sessions and ask Mother Ayahuasca, the spirit who lies behind the ayahuasca brew, for a story. And that's what I did. I went down to Brazil, and I had these 5 sessions over a period of 2 weeks, setting the intent at the beginning that I wanted to explore what possibilities I, as a creative writer, could develop in terms of fiction. And amazingly, over these 5 sessions, I was given pretty much the whole story that I later set down in writing in the form of my first novel, Entangled. I was shown the essential scenario of this story, that there would be 2 young women, one of them Leonie, in the 21st century, living in Los Angeles, a very damaged young woman, and the other Rhea, 24,000 years ago, in the Stone Age, and that these 2 young women are brought together by supernatural forces to do battle with a demon who travels through time. I was shown that time is not at all what we think it to be. It's not a straight line. It's not an arrow that goes from past through present to future. It's more like a knotted ball of string or a series of intersecting cycles and spirals. And I was shown a whole new vision of the Neanderthals, who also play an important part of this story. I mean, obviously, I'm cutting a long story very short here, but the basic element of the plot is that the demon called Sulpa is misleading human beings in the Stone Age to wipe out, to destroy, to kill off in the most awful ways the last Neanderthals. And the reason the demon wants human beings to do that is that if he can persuade them to do that, then he will gain sufficient psychic charge to jump forward across the centuries and manifest fully in physical form in the 21st century. And so the whole the whole battle of the book becomes to stop him doing that. And one of the mysteries of this whole project has been that insights I was given into the Neanderthals under the influence of ayahuasca have in the last 2 years been validated by so much mainstream science. And this suggests to me that in some mysterious process that I don't fully understand, those visionary experiences were tapping into the truth.
You have another novel sort of on deck, I understand?
Well, I've got a second volume of Entangled. Entangled is in two volumes, and I'm 100 pages into the second volume. It's a big story. It's really an epic story of the battle of good against evil, which I think has been a fundamental part of the human story since the beginning of time. It wasn't possible to tell it in one volume alone.
This evil that you're talking about, we've seen. I mean, even in your touring in the United States over the past years, we've seen how this block on consciousness, this chain on consciousness, is not just a fictional element in your story. It's something that's happening in the world right now as we speak. And there are two topics that I'd really love you to address if you could today. The first is privacy over our bodies, which I think you've had a lot to say in relation to the body scanners that are going in. And the other one is sovereignty over consciousness.
Yeah, in a sense, they're both interlinked. I had the experience of the naked body scanner in America. I spent the last 5 or 6 weeks traveling quite extensively around America, and in one airport, I forget which, I found myself confronted by the naked body scanner and a little notice in front of it saying that if I wished to do so, I could opt out, in which case I would be subjected to a pat-down. And I decided that I would opt out because I don't want all manner of mysterious radiation being beamed at my body, and I don't particularly want some remote viewer sitting looking at my naked form, which is actually my business and not his. And so I said, okay, I'm going to opt out. And then I was subjected to a really incredibly unpleasant experience, which I've subsequently learned many others have also suffered, which suggests to me that it is clearly a national policy at the moment. As soon as I said that I was going to opt out, security guards started shouting at the tops of their voices, opt out, opt out. And I was taken over to a place on full public view, other security guards gathered around me, and then one of them subjected me to the most aggressive, rape-like, violent physical search. It was really extremely abusive and alarming. In fact, really, really very, 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 very unpleasant, a deeply unpleasant experience, which went on for about 15 minutes. It was a full-scale physical humiliation. And now that I've learned that many others have subjected the same experience, it's obvious that what's going on here is that opt-out element is really just window dressing, and that what they're trying to do is to make the experience of opting out so unpleasant for us that all of us will just automatically opt in to the naked body scanner. And what I find really disturbing about that, it's not so much the issue of nakedness. I really don't care that much about it. It is the issue of obedience, that we are being taught a habit of automatic obedience to authority here. And I believe that automatic obedience to authority is a really bad thing. And you can see how when it's taken far enough, you can see how bad it gets, for example, in the case of what happened in Nazi Germany. The people we're saying yes to now may not be the people we're saying yes to in 20 years, but the habit of saying yes will be there and will be ingrained in us. What it does is it takes away from us our responsibility over ourselves and our own lives and hands it over to the state. And I feel exactly the same way over the issue of consciousness. I believe that the so-called war on drugs is a fundamental attack on human rights. I know that many drugs are dangerous and problematic, but I do not believe that the right way to solve those problems is to throw people in prison and invade their homes and ruin their lives with all the power and resources of the state. I believe very, very, very fundamentally that our consciousness must be our own business, and we must take responsibility for our own consciousness. And I believe that if I live in a society that does not allow me to be sovereign over my own consciousness, which is the most precious, the most fundamental, the most sentient, the most sacred part of myself, if I live in a society that will not allow me to be sovereign over that, then I can't be sovereign over anything at all. I think it's the last great human rights struggle. You know, we've had the struggle for civil rights, we've had the struggle for women's rights, we've had the struggle for gay rights. In every case, when we had this struggle, there were the prophets of doom who said that if those rights were granted, our society would collapse. In fact, the opposite is true. Our society has been strengthened by the granting of those rights. And I believe the same will be the case with our rights over our own consciousness. We need to dare to take this next step and to recognize that the adult's right to sovereignty over his or her own consciousness is an absolutely fundamental human right, and that the decision of society to send us to prison for exploring our own consciousness through the use of ancient and sacred plants that have been in use in human culture for thousands of years is a fundamentally anti-human rights decision.
Hear, hear. Can we win this struggle simply by asserting those rights?
By restoring those rights, we would change the entire nature of our society. The war on drugs has funded with public money gigantic armed bureaucracies which believe they have a right to invade the most private aspects of our daily lives. And I think that this has led to an erosion of the moral fabric of our society and has taken away responsibility from adults and put it and vested it in the hands of the state. I think that by making that single change, we would change the entire nature of the societies we live in. I don't believe that millions of people would suddenly start taking drugs. I think actually probably legalizing drugs would result in a reduction in the use of drugs. But I do believe that it's a litmus test to the kind of society that we live in. And by the way, in that context, I would like to mention the tobacco model, because those who prosecute the war on drugs claim that they're doing so for our own good, for the sake of our health, and that somehow it's good for us to face the threat of imprisonment and the ruining of our lives for exploring our consciousness with these illegal substances. But actually, if you look at a highly addictive and harmful substance like tobacco, which has never been subject to any criminal penalties, you don't get sent to prison for smoking a cigarette, but with good information, reliable information that people have trusted, what has happened in the last 20 years is that there's been a dramatic reduction in the consumption of tobacco. Nobody got sent to jail, but the information was good, and we acted rationally on the basis of that information. And I believe that would be the same with drugs. If any drugs are truly, seriously harmful, good information on its own is enough to stop rational people using those drugs. But punishment, cruelty, imprisonment, and the ruining of lives is not the way to go, and the tobacco model proves that, because the reduction of tobacco smoking has been very considerable and very successful in our society.
Well, I think that's a good point, a good place to wrap it up. Graham, thank you so much for taking an hour of your time with us today. It's been a great pleasure having you on the line.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you guys as well.
Immense thanks again to Graham Hancock. That was a really excellent interview and a real pleasure to talk to him.
Absolutely. And, you know, a real treat, like I said before, for me, because I'm a big fan of his work. So, and let me tell you this, one thing we didn't get to in the interview is that Graham's got a new book coming out next year. It's a remaking of one of his nonfiction books that wasn't released widely in the UK. It was originally called Talisman, and it's going to be called The Master Game. So check out that sometime in 2011 that's going to be coming out. That's a co-author with Robert Bovall, who we talked about in the interview and who was our first guest on this podcast 2 years ago. Keep your eyes peeled for that. But in the meantime, you know, check out Entangled. I've been enjoying, I don't read fiction very much, so it's like a pleasure cruise for me. And it's available like directly online, so you don't even necessarily, I don't even think you have to buy the physical book. I think there's an ebook of it available as well, which I know a lot of our listeners, if you're using things like podcasts, you might be interested in ebooks. So anyway, Joe, we've had a lot going on in the past couple of weeks. And somehow we didn't use it as an excuse not to do a podcast.
Right.
Most importantly, we were up in Boston this past week, and also in Waltham, Massachusetts, where we did an event at Backpages Books that I thought, Joe, I just thought it went really well, you know.
Yeah, in fact, there will be video for our first video podcast of this event at Backpages. And, you know, thanks to Alex at Backpages for hosting the event. Thanks to Brian Papchek from Hand Crank Productions for inviting us up and organizing it all. It was really just a great experience to be up there and meet all these people and meet some of the fans who listen to the show, in fact. And you know, hello to some of the new listeners who we met for the first time at the event last weekend.
Yeah, that was great. You know, it's very rare for me and Joe to, you know, get out and outside of podcast land, right into the realm of live appearances. So, yeah, check out that video podcast. It'll be our first video podcast ever. We've made like 80 or 90 broadcasts episodes over these past many years, but we've never done video before. So keep your eyes peeled for that. It'll come right out. It should come right out on the feed. You should be able to just download it directly in iTunes or whatever you're picking up the show with. So you'll actually...
And, you know, if you're in the Boston area, go check out Backpages Books, too, and say hi to Alex while you're there. It's a really great bookstore, actually.
Yeah, and they've had, I mean, Joe, we are like C-list compared to some of the people they've had at this place. Yeah. They've had like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and many other notable figures come and speak there. So I was just, once again, shocked at the response and the fact that we were received so warmly. And, you know, it made me feel a little like Matt Damon, you know, like a Boston intellectual in blue-collar clothing. It was great. So coming up, Joe, we've got Disinfo World News. We've got to get Joe Nolan and Austin Gandy back on the air. It's my mission. Lost interview with Robert Anton Wilson.
Yep.
Coming up before the end of the year, and a video podcast. So I think
that
should be enough to keep the spiders fed. No, really, I love you guys. And if you want to tell me what you think about me, ray@disinfo.com is my email address.
You can contact me at our old Out There address, outthereradio@gmail.com.
Out There Radio, you say?
That's right.
Perhaps you haven't heard our usual end of podcast monologue about our 50-episode podcast that we created between 2005 and 2008 called Out There Radio. It's all about the occult, conspiracy theories, hidden history, the paranormal, and other countercultural, psychedelic-style topics like that. You can pick that up here in the iTunes store. Just search for Out There, or at outthereradio.net if you want to do direct downloads. And then, of course, if you want to get other episodes of this show, just go to disinfo.com, you know, our home site, and click podcasts, and you'll be able to find us pretty quick, as well as episodes of a lot of other cool podcasts, other podcasters that we know, and people who are working really hard to bring this sort of fringe material out to an audience for free. Anyway, yeah, that's going to, I think, wrap it up for us this week on Disinformation, the podcast. My name is Raymond Wiley.
I'm Joe McFall. Thanks for listening.